Now, being an actor isn't necessarily about winning Academy Awards or owning mansions. Sometimes, it's simply about getting paid to do what you love. Fame is an extra perk. Bruce Campbell earned his share of fame the hard way. He broke through playing the character Ash in the indie horror movie The Evil Dead, the story of a group of young adults harassed by malevolent spirits in a mountain cabin. Here's Campbell as Ash, attacking the fiends with his trademark chainsaw.
Who's laughing now? Who's laughing now?
Evil Dead was just bad enough to be camp and just good enough to become a cult hit with a couple of sequels. Campbell writes about it in his new book, If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. He says, you don't have to be a superstar to get by as an actor.
Hey, folks, come on. There's a lot of coverage about all the Bruce Willises and Steven Spielbergs and guys like that, but for every one of those jokers, there are thousands of actors who actually do make a living that entertain us in all kinds of ways that we don't even remember, don't even know, anywhere from local car commercials to, you know, dancers at the Emmy Awards. And there's a lot of people who are all the support group. And there's, you know, you take a movie, Air Force One, starring Harrison Ford. Well, you look at the end credits, there's hundreds of actors in that movie and in every big A movie. But no one knows who they are. No one cares. They're all the supporting cast. But these are people who are trained. They're good at what they do. It's just no one cares.
And without them, those movies wouldn't be any good, actually.
Well, there wouldn't be a movie. And the same people with the crew behind it. I try and acknowledge the crew in making movies as much as any of the actors because they're just as important. I mean, the boom guy, if he screws up, you've got to replace that line later, and you might have liked how you did that line. Or the camera guy, you know. You can do the greatest performance in your life, but if you haven't told the focus puller where you're going to be going during your take, and as a result, you get out of focus, then it's your own fault. Because you haven't acknowledged them. I make it a point, hey, what's your name? Hey, how are you? You know, give them, you know, candy and Tic Tacs in the morning, whatever it takes to bond with these folks, because they can be your closest allies. And I think there's this whole royalty thing set up with big movies that, you know, oh, shh, quiet, quiet, so-and-so's on the set, don't talk. It's like, get out of here. You know, there's a lot of information that has to go back and forth between people. You know, with a focus puller, I'd usually say to them, okay, I promise I'll only get this close to the camera, and I promise I'll only go this far back, but I need this range to do my thing. And they'll go, fine. You make a deal with them.
How much of this is because you got into this so early? I mean, when you and your friends began making movies back when you were in, what, eighth grade?
Yeah.
Did you even know then what a focus puller was?
No, we didn't. Of course not. No. But by being involved in doing those crappy little independent films in high school and junior high school and then meeting guys from other neighborhoods, because high school was a... Junior high is a collection of grade school neighborhoods, and high school is a collection of junior high school neighborhoods. So we started meeting, myself and Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert, and then these other guys who were featured in the book that we met in class and had the same similar interest. We all did everything on the movies. There were no set jobs. The producer was just someone who bought the most film, you know, or who made the most phone calls. We needed a bunch of people for a pie fight. Okay, I'll make some calls. So, okay, I guess you're the producer. The one who came up with the most ideas is pretty much the writer. We had two or three directors, but eventually one would just get credited. So it taught us to do a bunch of different things.
Let's talk about Evil Dead for a little while, because that was your first big filmmaking.
That's right, our first film, period.
Your first film, period. But that was your entry into the world of filmmaking.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like it was what you expected it to be.
Nothing was, because we had no expectations. It was more like, geez, we got money from real investors. They signed a real piece of paper. This wasn't some, lend me $5,000 to go make a movie. This was sign on the dotted line, $10,000 a piece. We told them what we intended to do with the money. We told them when we thought we would get it back.
How many of you were involved at the beginning?
Three of us, myself and Sam Raimi, who I had met in drama class in high school, and then Rob Tappert, who was a Grosse Pointe kid, who I met once Sam went to college at Michigan State.
What did you have of the movie when you started? Did you know what you were going to do?
We had a script. We had done a prototype. on Super 8, because that was our millimeter of choice, we did about 50 Super 8 movies in high school, ranging from comedies to war films to dramas, detective films, pretty much everything. But we thought, okay, if we're getting real money from real investors, let's make one of the great staples of the movies. You can either pick a comedy. They've always made comedies, drama. We didn't think we were good enough at any of that. We thought, well, with a horror film, you don't have to have name actors, because George Romero did it with Night of the Living Dead. Who knew any of those people? Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Who knew any of those people? Tobe Hooper got these friends of his from Texas.
Well, and you're going to cut their heads off anyway.
Yeah, it's so. The same with John Carpenter. We're making Halloween. Who was Jamie Lee Curtis other than Tony Curtis's daughter? It's like big deal. Yeah. So we knew that we could make a movie cheap, and we knew that even if there was nobody in it that you recognized, chances are you could get it sold. But as a result, though, we said, okay, but we don't want to make a mainstream horror film that will get lost in the shuffle. We want to go for the gold here. No holds barred.
So what was going to be different about it?
It was going to be literally no holds barred. It was going to be, frankly, a gore fest.
Ash, it's not going to let us leave. We're all going to die here.
No, we're not going to die.
We're all going to die, all of us.
No, we're not going to die. We're not going to die. We're going to get out of here.
Don't you see? Ash, they're alive.
We did a lot of research at movie theaters, at drive-ins, some of the last remaining drive-ins in the late 70s in Michigan. If there was a boring spot in the movie, these people, they'd turn their headlights on and honk the horn and scream obscenities out their windows. And we went, okay, let's keep this thing moving for people. So we decided, if we're going to get into the horror world, let's not pussyfoot around. Let's go for it.
So at the point where they're going to start turning their headlights on,
something
more
happened.
Blood pours off the screen.
Kind of. There was a guy, Andy Granger, who was one of these crusty old exhibitor types that Rob Tappert's family knew. His mantra was, as a theater owner, if it's a horror picture, keep the blood running down the screen. He didn't care about the plot, didn't care about anything, but keep the blood running.
You made this film. It took you longer than you expected it to. You lost some people as you went along, and after that they were still in the movie but shot from the back or something like that.
Yeah, we did a whole series of pickups with people who were not them. The original shoot was supposed to be 6 weeks long, and it went 12 weeks long. So we had people who had to go back to school. They had jobs they had to go back to. They went home for the holidays. They were like, forget you guys. So we shot whatever we needed to from the front, and then from behind, we just used other people. They put the shirt on. They put a wig on or whatever.
There was a name you used for it from the Three Stooges?
Yeah, they were shimping. Shemp was a member of the Three Stooges at one point. There was Mo, Larry, and Curly is what most people remember. But Shemp worked with them for a time. They would make a bunch of them at the same time, and Shemp had a heart attack and died. So they had to finish off three or four shorts with a fake Shemp, a guy who just came in and covered up his face really poorly. And then Mo, just to get him out, would go, Shemp, go guard the door. And he'd go, right. And they would dub in his old lines until he got out of the shot. And we used to watch it every day after high school, and we thought, what is with that? We noticed, because we were starting to notice editing and filmmaking techniques. We went, that guy's not Shemp. So we just used that term for anyone who was in your movie that you couldn't recognize. So if we had a guy's feet walking across the floor or a hand on a doorknob, we put their name in the credits under fake Shemps. So, and we kept that credit to this day.
Yeah.
All extras would be fake Shemps.
All right, you got the thing finished.
Yeah.
How did you get it seen?
Three times a year, they'd have these festivals around the world, markets, film markets, where you would buy and sell independent movies like they were widgets. And there was this guy named Irvin Shapiro, and we would notice that his company always handled like George Romero movies and these creepy, scary Dario Argento movies. And we thought, well, maybe he'll get what it is that we've got. So we contacted him. He was 85 years old when we met him. This guy went all the way back to the 20s, and was a really honorable guy, and he saw our film and said, well, it's not exactly Gone with the Wind, but I think we can make some money with it, because he knew who to sell it to. And he held our hand through the foreign sales market. We didn't know anything about that. It's like, you make a movie, you show it in the States, forget about it. But we didn't know anything about, well, A lot of people sell their movie overseas to make their production cost back, and then all the profit from the States is gravy. And we didn't know anything about that. And he said, well, okay, here we'll sell it to England, Japan, Germany, Italy, France. We were like, wow, that's amazing. And we also thought we would get ripped off overseas and that we'd make all our big profit in the United States. And it turned out to be completely the opposite. Foreign companies were very fair with us. They gave us overage checks when the film did well. They kept track of our money, and the people in the States were just criminals.
You know, listening to you talk about this, you obviously had a good time. You have very fond memories of this. It's made your career in a lot of ways. I mean,
it gave you
an in to Hollywood.
Oh, absolutely. People, they bring up the Evil Dead question, and they usually are very tentative with it and hesitant because they think I'm going to say, I don't want to talk about that anymore. But I can relate everything that I've done today directly back in a connected link to that first crappy little horror film.
But on the other hand, a few minutes ago you said you cringe a little bit every time they say Bruce Campbell, best known for
Evil Dead. It's a two-edged sword. So eventually I'll just make peace with the whole thing and not worry about it one way or the other.
Bruce Campbell on his new book, If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor.